This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Love letters, as you know, are for anyone, anytime, and for any reason you have a thought that you want to express compassionately or lovingly. Just, it's so worth doing. And today's guest, actually, I met at a writer's workshop, and she held up a picture of her father, and I could see from what was on her face that I wanted her to come do a Love Letters Live with me. My guest is Persis Karim. She is a poet, a writer, and a professor of literature and creative writing at San Jose State, and has a very complicated, interesting life and concept to talk about and to live, actually. So, Persis, I'm going to go to you, and I'm just going to ask you to start right in, because one of the things we were talking about was the concept of diaspora in modern life, where the world is such a tiny little globe, and really, what's the difference where you live one place or another anymore? It's not like when you leave home, you're so lost, you can find community. What has that been to you?
Well, I think that my expression of either diaspora or migration is informed by my own parents, mm-hmm. who came to the United States after World War II from their respective countries of Iran.
And now, why did they leave Iran? How did they get here?
So both of my parents came here in what I would say was an accidental immigration, mm-hmm. that my father came here after World War II because he was responsible for supervising the building of the railroad system in Iran, which was used for transporting munitions to the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. during the height of the Second World War. And Iran was occupied by the British and the Russians. And he ended up coming here because as the war winded down, they wanted to convert the railroad system from military to civilian use. Oh. And Iran had had no previous history of railroads except for during this war, mm-hmm. period. So my dad was sent to the United States to study the U.S. railway system. They sent him a ticket. He was supposed to ride the railroads for a year, which he did, and he wrote a report, sent it back to Iran, and never heard anything back. And my father, who I think was pretty sophisticated about the politics of the country, saw in the period when Iran was occupied that it would not be free, that the interest in oil...
And, this is now in the 40s?
Yes. Uh-huh. The war ended, and the occupation ended around 1945. And my father really sensed that Iran would never really have its own democratic system because of the influence of Europe, particularly the British interest in oil. The Soviet Union was interested in Iran because it, shared a border in the north. Mm-hmm. And my father, who had been sort of politically involved, not as much as his older brother, but really sensed that Iran was destined to be, controlled by outsiders.
But when you say he was politically involved in a way that staying there would have ultimately been dangerous for him?
Yeah.
Okay. Because he didn't leave in fear or flight.
No, he didn't leave in uh-huh. fear or flight. But he sensed that if he were to stay in Iran... that he told me, had I stayed in Iran, I would have been either dead or in jail.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. That's what I want. And your mother, how did she come here?
My mother came here because during the war, her family was really affected by the war. Her younger brother was killed in a tank accident early in the war, and her older brother was a prisoner of war in Poland. And she was essentially...
How was her older brother in Poland?
He was in a prisoner of war camp because he was a...
Soldier.
Captain, soldier, uh-huh. Fighting the Nazi occupation in France. He lived in a prisoner of war camp and eventually escaped.
But what army was he in?
The French Resistance.
I see. Okay. So that's already another whole story.
Yes.
To get from, okay. I was a little off my trail here.
Yeah,
okay,
that's
good.
Okay.
All right.
Essentially, both my parents, I think, were very much a product of an uncertain time in their respective countries when the whole world was sort of thrown into chaos as a result of World War II. But I think in their own respective ways, they were looking for a better future for themselves. My father, I think, had always dreamed of coming to America. He had been born in France in 1915. Oh. His father had been involved in a commerce of selling textiles, importing textiles from Iran to France. So my father's early life had been in France, and then they went back to Iran after World War I started.
So, but your basic ancestry is from Iran?
Yes.
Okay, so that period in France was a temporary...
An accident.
Okay.
And I would say that in some ways it really created wanderlust in my father.
Uh-huh.
From a very early age, he had this experience of being elsewhere and living elsewhere.
And he was comfortable elsewhere.
Okay. So he always dreamed of coming to the United States. He read a book when he was an adolescent by an Iranian writer, A Year in America. I have never found the book, but that's what my father told me.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this fantasy of coming to the U.S. because he believed that it represented the pinnacle of Western democracy.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to come as a boy. He saved up money. He told his only one person he told, it was his aunt, and he told her that he was going to save up money, buy a bus ticket to Iraq, and then take a boat from Iraq to the United States. And when he was 18, he accumulated enough money to do that, and his father found out about it, took him off the bus, and said, "You will go nowhere. You'll get an education."
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, you know, my father forestalled that dream of coming to the United States, and then he, as a young man of 30, 31, he was sent officially to come to the U.S. to study the railroads.
Okay, so you were born here.
Yes.
Where were you born?
I was born in Walnut Creek, California.
Okay. Now, are your parents still alive?
No, they're both deceased.
They're
my
both
father
gone.
Died in 2005, 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and my mother died in 2011.
Now, when you were holding up that picture of him, there was definitely a longing.
Yeah.
And it was a memoir writing workshop. What was your intent? And what are you looking at and what are you looking for when you think about your father, your parents?
I think about my parents as people who were incredibly humble
mm-hmm.
and resilient and who endured a lot of hardship, not you know, suffering and poverty, but like the idea of being solitary and alone without their respective families and forging a new life in this new place.
Did you feel that sorrow in your house?
I wouldn't say sorrow. Mm-hmm. I would say it was a kind of longing mm-hmm. for something else.
Mm-hmm. And is that what brings the word diaspora into your life? And I know this is a lot, but what's your connection with the Iranian community? I know that you've edited books here.
Okay. Well, my connection with the Iranian community has been one that I had to connect with and create on my own.
Yeah.
It wasn't there. My parents came here, and my dad said in the entire time that he lived here, the first 15 years of his life, he never spoke a word of Persian.
Wow.
And knew no other Iranians. And for my mother, you know, France was not so remote. And mm-hmm. so their experience, I think, of rooting themselves here was one of really choosing to leave behind. I mean, people don't immigrate like that anymore because they have the internet and they have Skype. But, you know, they were part of that early 20th century experience of, like, when you left, you really left.
Exactly.
And it wasn't easy to go back.
Right.
I mean, you could go back and visit, but, you know, if you imagine, I was thinking about this, my parents took boats to
mm-hmm,
come here,
mm-hmm.
right? And you took a boat.
That's a time commitment.
It's a time commitment, and it literally represents the idea of the journey. In
right,
a way
you feel
that,
the distance.
Yeah.
Across, yes.
And so I think my parents were a little bit unconscious about, like, how
mm-hmm.
significant it was to, like, you know, leave behind. And they didn't really come here, like, Oh, they were going to, like...
They were not fleeing the Ayatollah. I mean, they
weren't fleeing the Ayatollah, and they weren't really fleeing... I think they were fleeing the idea that their lives were limited.
Okay, so there's a difference between fleeing danger and leaving to come to something, running from something or to something.
Correct.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, and I think that for them, the U.S. represented the idea of possibility and reinvention.
Were those realized?
Oh, I would say so. Mm-hmm. In the case of my father, I think he was an extremely ambitious guy, mm-hmm. and passionate about a lot of things.
Like what?
He wanted to be a writer. Like, mm-hmm. I recently, my mother's house, we finally sold it this last summer, and I found a box of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was writing memoirs and short stories. Oh. In 1950, and he had been here less than 4 years, and he was trained as an engineer. So I think my father was looking to reinvent himself as an artist, because at the time of his upbringing in Iran, while he came from a culture that esteemed art, nobody wanted their son to be an artist. They wanted him to be an engineer or a doctor.
Well, you find that here, too. I mean, I think that's the parental safety valve kicking in, that you want your child to be able to earn a living and feed himself.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think for my mother, the reinvention occurred. She came from a French Protestant family, and her grandfather was a Huguenot minister.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was looking for a place to be less sheltered and also to discover herself.
Mm.
So she had an education, you know, a high school education, but didn't have a sense that anything beyond that was going to come her way. She was under a lot of pressure to marry. And if you can imagine a young woman of 25 at the height of World War II looking for a husband when there weren't very many, mm-hmm. to be found. And she was trained as a, during the war, she got her Montessori license. Oh. Maria Montessori had fled Italy and then ended up in Switzerland, and then in France. And my mother studied under Maria Montessori.
So she taught when she was here?
So she came here, and then she started a school. But during the war, she had also worked with Jewish orphans. She worked for an organization that was helping to place Jewish children who'd been separated from their parents, who were destined for the camps. And she worked in placing them in safe houses within France. And I think that experience was... I believe it was very traumatic for her. The whole war experience, mm-hmm. was very, mm-hmm. traumatic for her. She lost a brother. Her older brother was in a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
And then she was working with Jewish children who had basically been...
So she was just seeped in disaster.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I think that coming to the U.S., while it was an accident, she came here, she got a job in a children's... research Montessori lab at the University of Chicago, and she worked as a French dorm mother at the University of Chicago. She didn't really say, I'm going to the U.S. to immigrate. Mm-hmm. She was looking for work, and I think...
How did she meet your father?
She met my father at the University of Chicago, International House.
Oh, how nice. Okay.
Waltzing on the dance floor.
Perfect. Let me ask you something. When you went through the writings of your father... and they were things he remembered and things he was writing. Did you find yourself in them?
Yeah, I think I did. I found, the first thing that it was really...
You're smiling, so I'm guessing that that's big.
Well, I think my father, he didn't allow himself to be that vulnerable. And so what I saw in these writings was like this really much more vulnerable, much more introspective person than he often let himself be, because he was the patriarch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I found in him was this sort of yearning to connect through art and literature.
Connect with
others,
uh-huh.
and with oneself, mm-hmm. on a deeper level. And also a kind of a desire to, like, be in story. The idea that stories are a kind of oxygen, and they give us a sense of who we are, but also the idea that you can make up who you are. So the invention, I think, was really what I really saw in myself and in these writings.
Do you think people make up who they are, or they tap into parts of themselves and let that part shine?
I think they do both. Mm-hmm. And I think as you get older, you start maybe to reside more in the place of your own truth about who you are, and less about the fantasy of who
you are. How old was he when he died?
He was 89.
Oh, so he had lived a very long...
Yeah, he wanted to live to be 100. He was really fascinated by the idea of stretching into the next...
Oh, yes, what's coming next.
Yeah. But
so that's kind of an adventurous soul right there, too.
Yeah, he was really... For me, like what you saw, what you witnessed in that workshop mm-hmm. was a kind of... he was like an intellectual mentor for me, somebody who had an incredible passion for life and discovery and saw everything as an opportunity.
So he allowed that to blossom in you.
I like to hope so and think so. Yeah, I'm very grateful for that. And people tell me that I'm passionate in the same way I think my father was passionate about mm-hmm. life and also about finding and creating meaning in all kinds of things.
Now, I read what you wrote. I read on your blog what you wrote about your father starting with holding up that picture and wondering about the picture.
Yeah.
And who took it and why his hands were holding the coat the way they were.
Yeah.
And those were all really moving and touching observations. And I did wonder about the more personal aspect of him. And maybe that you couldn't see so much until you read those notes and letters.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, I think for my father, he came from a culture where men and sort of patriarchal culture insisted upon the idea of authority.
Yes.
And, much of my life, he was like that. You know, he had 8 children. And,
oh, I didn't ask about that.
I'm the youngest of mm-hmm. his 8 children. And I think he, as an immigrant, he was also insisting upon the idea that, like, he wanted us all to succeed, and therefore he really impressed upon us.
You know, that is a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
For a man. You know, we think about women who just keep having babies and how hard it is on them. But for a man to head a family of 8 children, that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see where you would take the stance of authority.
Yeah.
You can't
afford
to get soggy.
Yeah, and when you're in a place that is not your own culture,
yes.
you work even harder to, like,
right.
keep people in line because you don't know what's out beyond there.
Right.
So, but as I got older and I cultivated a more intimate relationship with him in terms of spending time with him, and we, like, you know... hiked together. He lived in, after my parents' divorce, he moved to Lake Tahoe.
Oh, I didn't realize about that.
Yeah. And then he moved to Reno, and then he started a master's program at the age of 75.
So, my goodness. So, how old were you when they divorced?
I was 17 when they divorced.
Was that a shock of a...
No.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't a shock. They had a lot of problems. I mean, I think now, again... We live in a time where bicultural marriages or cross-cultural marriages are much more common, and there's a kind of support and mm-hmm. awareness of it, whereas in my parents' uh-huh. generation, I think it was much more unusual. And the idea of how do you forge a relationship with all these children
yes.
in a third country. So I think that they lacked in certain areas because they didn't have the support or the recognition about what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now people, it's a much more common experience.
Yes.
So my father, after they divorced, when I was 17, my father moved to Lake Tahoe because we had a cabin up there and he loved it up there. Mm-hmm. And then he was always interested in going back to school.
Uh-huh.
So he ended up doing a master's in geology because he had been a mining engineer. He went from civil engineer to mining engineer. And so he was fascinated with the earth and the story of the earth. And he believed that geology could tell us a lot about our own human story. And then he started a PhD program when he was about 79 or 80 in something called global climate change, before we were even using climate change as readily as we do now. And that experience of trying to do a PhD when he was an 80-year-old man, he experienced a lot of prejudice. You know, people didn't take him seriously.
Because he was so old?
Yeah, even though he was an interesting old guy.
It's really a lot of nerve when you think about it. Yeah.
So he ended up...
Including the teachers?
No, some of his teachers really loved him because they always said he asked the best questions and he was the most committed.
Did they see that as dilettantish since he wasn't building a career?
I think the people who he tried to get to take him seriously didn't see him as a serious candidate because it was like the idea of
why would you be bothering?
So he got discouraged.
That's so sad because education should be for its own sake, not so that you can get a job. I mean, both are important. God knows, but
yeah. And I think that experience made him really reflect. Like, well, you know what? I have a lot of stories inside me. So he ended up abandoning the PhD sort of right at the start of the dissertation, and then he started taking creative writing classes.
Oh, my goodness, the plot thickens.
And then he, like, was writing mostly fiction. And, you know, his prose was a little bit stiff, like the engineer in him hadn't quite softened. So I became sort of his editor, and, you know, he wrote a lot of stuff. And that, I think that experience of being really connected to him through the writing was something that gave me a glimpse into him and his vulnerability. And I feel like that's the person that I got to know. He was no longer just my father. He was a really interesting character, and he was an interesting character in his own writing, you know? So I liked that image of him standing there with the New York skyline behind him in some ways is like the beginning of that journey. And at the end of his life, I think he had so much energy and enthusiasm for continuing to live his story.
So this is interesting to me because we just met and I don't know you at all except for today. And the way you were holding up that picture seemed like, because he had died, it seemed like it was the end of a story you were telling. And I can see that it's not.
No.
Holding up that picture is a beginning for you of looking into something. So you're looking to write a memoir. And I, of course, equate that. I mean, what love letter and letter of memory, they're so related. So it's time for me to say to you, really, to ask you what you want to say to him in this memoir. And how much confidence do you have that you're going to find the him that you didn't know before in doing this? I mean, you're sifting through your own life looking for him.
Right.
Isn't that what that
is? Right. Well, I think what I would want to say to him is, you know, it's like a kind of homage to the journey of his life that enabled my life, which is, you know, like I think about both my parents. I even get emotional thinking about
it. You should. I'm going to get emotional.
That they did this incredible thing, which was to like pick up and make their life somewhere else.
Yes.
Made a life together, albeit at moments troubled and challenging. And then they gave us this really good life, you know, and that good life was, I think, very much influenced by my parents' curiosity. Like I would say that the one thing I loved above and beyond anything else in my father was his incredible curiosity about everything, and that everything was an opportunity for discovery.
I have a question though, as far as this memoir, and you're talking about diaspora and a longing that you had, even though you are a California girl.
Yes.
By definition, technically.
Yes.
When you look back, I see sometimes in families who have come from elsewhere that in their zeal to give their children what they didn't have, they can forget to give their children what they did have.
Right.
And you said he didn't speak Farsi for 15 years? So
yeah.
Can you talk about how's your longing connected to all of this? And what would you say? And would you, there's something about writing letters, by the way, for memoir, I think, or just communicating that's easier because you're actually talking to him.
Yes.
It may be kind of a, you know, a.
Well, I, you know, this is true for both my parents. I think that I also, like, one of the things that I enjoyed about them as an as a young adult, up until the time they died, was that I wrote letters to and with them. So I was in graduate school in Texas for 8 years, and I wrote very regularly to both my parents.
Do you have all these now?
Yeah, I don't have all the ones I sent them, but I have all the ones they sent me. And for my dad was a deeply philosophical guy. So everything that came out of his mouth was in some ways, philosophically, informed. So he was very curious about politics. He was curious about science. He was curious about art. And he had sort of a general philosophy that, like, you have to be curious in order to really know who you are. And everything around you is information. So a lot of those letters between us, I think, were deeply philosophical. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he was offering me, like, the hard-headed parental advice that at the time I didn't want, but now I'm so grateful that he gave it to me because I think about
it. Will that be part of your memoir?
I think so,
Which I'm calling a love letter, like to thank him for...
Yeah, I think it will be. And I also feel like my mother did some of the same kind of thing. My mother was a much more humble, soft-spoken, less bombastic character. But she was an artist, deeply kind of interested in the world of creating. She was a potter, she started taking pottery classes when she was, you know, in her late 40s and then did it right up until her death. And she made things like she sewed. She loved her hands. My dad loved his mind. My mother loves her hands. And I like to think that I'm a little bit of a combination.
Well, I was going to say there is being grateful for the genetic combination.
Right.
And also for the cultural that you got and the creative, yes.
Yeah. And sometimes, like this weekend, we went to Mendocino for a week, my husband and my son, and I was collecting driftwood. And my mother used to do that. Mm-hmm. She would collect driftwood and make things with it. And I saw like 3 pieces of driftwood. I brought them home. And then I said to myself, when the new year comes, I'm going to make something. So I painted a piece of wood like a crocodile. And I was like channeling my mother. I could feel it. Like,
don't we do that? Yes.
Yeah.
Your husband Iranian?
No, he's a Jewish American man who also grew up in the East Bay. And he's a scientist. And he loves science and teaches science.
How old is your son?
My son is 12. And he's a painter.
So you're carrying an enormous amount of stuff inside you. I mean,
you're asking me, I'm making it available.
Well, but whether you make it available or not, I'm grateful that you are, to me, you're still carrying it.
Yes.
A very, very complicated, I can see where you would really have to get this out on paper.
Well, I think I haven't been ready until very recently. And I think part of the work that I did on these anthologies was... Strangely, I had to do the collective community story to connect to it so that I could feel the confidence about my own story. And I think that sometimes you need to help others so you can help yourself.
Oh, yes.
And that was
teaching is the best way of, learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sort of tired of, like, putting out for everybody else.
Okay, good.
So... I'm on a sabbatical this year, and that I've been doing a lot of writing and creating and conceiving and thinking like much more concretely about this memoir and trying to figure out still like what the frame of it is, because I feel like I do want to write about both of my parents. Mm-hmm. And I also want to write about the experience of, you know, my attempt to navigate this whole thing, you know?
Yes. So, and what formed you?
Yeah, what formed me?
I mean, that is such an interesting business.
It is.
Yeah.
And, you know, like sometimes I wonder, I ask myself, you know, is this really interesting to other people? And then I tell people some of the details, for example, about my dad or about my mom. And I think it's interesting.
I think interesting is how you say it.
Yeah.
I have read things that you would think on the face of it would not be interesting. I'm reading a book about boxing right now. Who would have thought? I can't put it down. Every story is so worth telling and part of us all. You know, what you write down will touch others who will say, oh, me too.
Yeah.
You know, oh, thank you so much for doing this with me. I'm guessing that eventually we will be able to read this memoir.
Yes,
and
you will.
I look forward to
working on it. Oh,
and I hope you'll maybe come back when you have the next thing you want to share with us.
I would be happy to do
that.
You
thank you so much. Well, until next time, please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter and a memoir is a special occasion all its own. Till next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye, and
thank you, Janet. It's a
pleasure.
Versus
Kareem saying goodbye, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, was that a half hour?